the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. I'm Ben. This is Alan. Alan, how are you?
I'm fine. I've got the sniffles. Lots of allergies tonight for some reason. Excuse me in advance if I sniff and sneeze and whatever. And everyone out there, please forgive Ben if he doesn't edit them all out.
Well, terrific that you're able to soldier on for us, Alan, filling in for Johnny, of course, this week with Johnny's mum in town. And I hope he still managed to have a good time. He definitely picked a good week to not appear on the podcast, Alan. It wasn't the best week for Gumba, was it?
No comment. Wasn't at all, was it? Especially if we're going to start with the Levan Cup.
Absolutely, yes. Gumba tasting defeat in midweek in the Levan Cup and then also on Sunday as well in J1. And yes, we'll come on to all of the games from J1 match day 10 soon. But some business we have to attend to from last midweek. And indeed, heading into this week as well, as we begin with Japan's under-23s at the Asian Cup Olympic qualification tournament over in Qatar. And Alan, this was quite a game. Well, last Thursday night, finished in the early hours of a Friday morning Japan time, of course. Japan taking on the hosts Qatar in the quarterfinal stage of this competition. A loss would have meant that their dreams of heading to Paris were shot, but instead, after a truly remarkable game, Japan have made it through to the semi-finals after beating Qatar 4-2 after extra time.
Yeah, it was an interesting game, wasn't it? I'm not sure if Japan were doing the right thing, and basically they're resting all those players and then losing to Korea. And I thought, now they've got Qatar instead of Indonesia, but it turned out to be the right call, it seems. Mm. And good luck to Indonesia. Hope to see them in the final. But let's get back to Japan. Yeah, it was an interesting game. I mean, I presume that this was basically the full strength or the best choice players that the manager could choose. I guess he'd rested some and he'd saved some. But perhaps the turning point was the goalkeeper doing that ridiculously unnecessary kick to get the red card, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, Fuki Yamada had given Japan the lead in the second minute. Qatar had equalised midway through the first half. But, yeah, Alan, as you say, the Qatar keeper had raced out to try and head the ball clear under pressure from Mal Hosoya and, well, succeeded in heading the ball away, but also succeeded in giving Hosoya a decent kick to his midsection. And, before 4 minutes before halftime, he saw himself sent off after VAR suggested, the referee go over and have a look. It's a kind of a tricky one, I guess. You can see, the keeper doesn't look directly at Hosoya and necessarily kick out at him. But I don't know, you were of the opinion that this was definitely a deliberate act and not a reflexive one by the Qatar keeper?
Yes, it was totally unnecessary. He wasn't really under pressure. He managed to get the ball, but it seemed to be, in my opinion, I think he did look to where the player was and then out went the kick. And it wasn't like lifting the leg. It was like you pushed the leg into the guy. I mean, it was really weird because it was totally unnecessary. Rush of blood to the head, I suppose they call that. And they were down to 10 men, and Japan went on for that. I mean, they had, 25 shots or so compared to about 8 or 9 from Qatar, I think. I mean, they were well in control, I think, anyway. And in the end, it was like 75% possession or something as well. Mm. No complaints. I think it was going into it. There was a slight, concern being up against the host nation. But no, in the end, it was quite an easy game. Although, as you say, it went to extra time, but 2 goals in extra time. And Hosoya finally came good because he hasn't had that such a good tournament at all, really, has he? And then Kotaro Uchino managed to get himself on the score sheet and make a slight small name for himself as well.
Yep, absolutely. So, yeah, Japan making it through to the semifinals of this competition, as we say, a 4-2 after extra time. And, they will face Iraq in the semifinals, Iraq defeating Vietnam. And, on the other side of the draw, I mean, the huge story, of course, is Indonesia, who did terrifically in the group stage. And then, to beat South Korea 11-10 on penalties after extra time, ending Korea's long run of Olympic qualification in men's football. And I think now Japan has the longer streak, and they'll extend their new record if they can make it through. Basically, if they can beat Iraq, and this game kicks off not long after we'll finish your recording tonight, listeners. So you will know the score by the time you listen to this episode. But as we're recording, yes, it's yet to kick off. But yeah, if Japan can win that game, they're assured of qualification to the Paris Olympics. If they fail to beat Iraq, then they'll go through to the third place playoff. If they win that, they'll also qualify directly. If not, then they will have a playoff against a nation from another region. All right, so that's terrific for Japan to make it through to the semifinals of the Under-23 Asian Cup. Also in last midweek, last Wednesday night, we had the second round of the Levain Cup. Roundup, there were 9 games played and 7 of them involved J1 clubs. And yes, a little bit different than the previous week. We most definitely did have some cup sets. And I must apologize to, not only Johnny, but all Gumba fans for jinxing them on last week's episode. I thought that they would have much more than enough to cruise by FC Ryukyu. But unfortunately, for Gumba supporters, my reverse jinx was in full effect. And down in Okinawa, Ryukyu beat Gumba 2-1. J1 teams being defeated were a Kyoto. They lost at Nagano, who came from 2-0 down to beat Sanga 3-2 after extra time. Also going to extra time was a Shonan's trip to Akita. Blaublitz claimed that a victory 2-1. And in the it wasn't a cup set, but in the Kyushu Derby down in Kumamoto, Sagan Tosu beat Roasso 1-0. Amongst the goals were Hiroshima and Urawa. Hiroshima put 6 past Nara, and Reds beat Tottori 5-2. But yeah, I guess a terrible story for Gumba Osaka. And I just have to apologize, Alan, and hold my hands up. And I didn't realize my reverse jinx was quite that powerful.
These things happen, right? I think, I think the Levain Cup itself this year, I mean, I'm sure we all realize how good it's been. And I think other countries around the world could look at this. I mean, imagine the English FA Cup having to draw, and then literally the lower team gets the home game if they want it. Of course, some teams might want to be, Wrexham might prefer to play at Old Trafford to get more money out of it in the end. But having the lower team get the home game automatically has been excellent. And a lot of the players are being pushed. I mean, Gamba didn't want it. And now Gamba have lost, and now Cerezo have to travel to Ryukyu as well. So I think the home teams are up for it. The lesser teams are up for it. And some of the teams have gone quite full strength. I think San Freccio were quite high, and Reds were very close to full strength. Gamba probably deserved this because they seem to treat it like a training match. I think only Ichimori, the goalkeeper, was the first choice player. And even he was there probably only because Higashiguchi doesn't seem to be ready, and the third keeper's no good. So they've got like an 18-year-old Chinese player as a substitute goalkeeper at the moment. So they probably would have switched the keeper as well. So it was a completely reserve team to get the excuse in advance there. But Ryukyu are up for it. It was excellent. It's good to see. I mean, I'm really enjoying the teams getting the lesser games. And even Nara Club, I mean, they lost 6-0, but I'm sure it was good fun to get all those San Freccio team players down there and have a good time. And the next round looking good for, I think, what is it, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. How many games are left? 16, 32 teams left? Is it correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, the ACL clubs have got to come in later in the competition, of course, including Kofu, Kawasaki, and F Marinos. So they still have to join the competition later on. But in the third round that would be played on Wednesday, May the 22nd, we have 4 all J1 ties on the slate. Machida will travel to Kashima. Hiroshima will head to Tokyo Verde. Fukuoka will pop up to Chiba to face Kashiwa. And all FC Tokyo supporters were filled with dread when they saw that their team had been drawn away at Tosu. So heading down to our island of horrors, Kyushu, yet again. But, well, yes, we'll wait and see how all of those games pan out next month. So that was last Wednesday's Levain Cup action taken care of. And, of course, also on Wednesday night, there was a huge game that took place at the Nissan Stadium. And after a quick hit of music, Stuart Woodward will join us to talk about one of the best nights in Yokohama F. Marinos' history. Welcome back. And yeah, it was a huge occasion in the rain at the Nissan Stadium last Wednesday night. Yokohama F. Marinos making it through to a first ever Asian Champions League final. And Stuart Woodward was there. Stuart, welcome back to the pod. Have you just about recovered?
Well, I just about recovered. But then I went to Osaka at the weekend and I saw them play Cerezo as well. So it's been a very busy month, actually. Yeah,
I mean, I can't imagine how difficult it must have been for the players to, well, I'm sure 60% of them were still drunk after the celebrations for Wednesday night. How they managed to head down to Osaka and give Cerezo a game is, well, yeah, one of the more remarkable things I think I've seen in Japanese football in recent times. I'm sure about 95% of the supporters were still drunk down in Osaka on the weekend, Stuart.
Well, I guess so, yeah. But they're also quite well attended in Osaka. Like lots of people there, and people planning making airline reservations to go to Dubai to the match. I unfortunately won't be going. I'm a little bit busy with work at the moment. But some of my circle are definitely going.
That's brilliant. Great to hear. So, yeah, let's just round up the events from last Wednesday night. It was, truly a remarkable occasion. Of course, F. Marinos 1-0 down from the first leg in South Korea the previous Wednesday, but the hosts roared out of the gates. It's very safe to say, an understatement to say. And, three absolutely terrific goals, two of them from Asahi Wainaka, his first in the 13th minute. Anderson Lopez made it 2-0 in the 21st. And then on the half hour, if you had to pick one out, yes, I guess it would be Wainaka's stunner from 25 yards in the 30th minute that gave F. Marinos a 3-1 advantage in the tie. But, things are never that simple, are they? And Ulsan grabbed a goal back 5 minutes later. And then I'm sure all F. Marinos supporters were filled with dread when defender Takumi Kamijima was shown a straight red card for a sliding handball in the box in the 39th minute. The resulting penalty was finally scored by Ulsan at 3 minutes before half time. But before I get Stuart's thoughts on a wild and woolly first half, Alan, I was under the impression that a defender would only be sent off when a penalty was conceded if it was considered, you know, rough play or dangerous play. But I wasn't aware that a handball, unless it was blocking a ball on the line, of course, was still grounds for a red card. All this double jeopardy, triple jeopardy stuff, or have I just been led down the garden path? And was that an appropriate decision in your minds to send off Kamijima?
Have you got the beeper ready? It was total.
Right.
In my opinion, and as far as I know, as you say, according to the rules, it was not an intentional handball. It's not like the guy was completely through on goal. There was still, he hadn't even got the ball completely under control. There wasn't a shot. Then he didn't put his arm out to block the ball or the player. For me, it wasn't anywhere near a dogzo, which would only happen outside the area anyway, or wasn't rough play, it wasn't fair play, it wasn't even really unfair. I don't think he did it on purpose. So it was, for me, this was a shocking decision. And I thought, I'd like to hear a fan's take on that, Stuart, which I guess you're going to do next. But for me, as a referee and as a neutral, but of course I was supporting the Japanese team, this was quite a ridiculous decision, and I'm still not over it.
Well, I think from my point of view, the penalty, the penalty shootout kind of cleared my memory of everything that happened up until that point. Because, like, from I was on the total on the opposite side behind the goal at the opposite corner, so I couldn't even see why he'd got a red card at all at that point. And then okay, we get the VAR replays, and it was so long. The match was so delayed by VAR. I think the referee went off at least twice, and we played the whole, I think, over 90 minutes without him after that. So it really changed the course of the game. Obviously, allowed them to level up in terms of the aggregate score. But I was just thinking now, I haven't looked back at the replay of that one, so I'll have to go back and have a look again. A look at that. I've watched all of the other matches up until the last match tonight, because many of those I saw at the stadium or under the influence with friends. So I'm interested. Well, glad to hear that you think it was an unfair decision. But of all the players, Kajijima worries me the most about getting sent off, because he's quite aggressive, and he's like the last defense in many cases, unless William Pop comes out the box and tries to do some judo on the player. But it was funny, because at 30 minutes I turned to my good friend Kenji and I said, well, we won't be needing penalties tonight. And he told me, shut up, shut up. And then it all went down to pot after that.
Kenji, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, Alan and I spoke at the start of the episode, Stuart, about, my reverse jinx being in full effect. And, obviously you were happy that Ryukyu beat Gumba in the Levain Cup on the same evening. Well, yeah, that was in large part to me reverse jinxing Gumba on last week's episode, I'm certain. But, there you go. That's happened to you as well. And, by hook or by crook, F. Marino's just about made it to spot kicks, didn't they, after, as Stuart said, playing basically 90 minutes with only 10 men after Kamijima was sent off. I think F. Marinos might have got a little bit fortunate, Alan, with the Ulsan goal in inverted commas early in the second half that was disallowed for offside, with a player deemed to be, I guess, in William Pope's line of sight, even though for me that was another decision I think the officiating team got wrong. But from that point on, apart from Jan Matthijs having a header chalked off for offside, it was pretty much one way traffic, and they were indebted, weren't they, to Pope for several immense saves. And I mean, the woodwork came to their rescue a couple of times as well. But it was just a remarkable rear guard action from F. Marinos, Alan.
Indeed, I think. To go back to your decisions, I think the Ulsan non-goal was correct, and I immediately said to the TV, shouted at the TV, that's offside, it's got to be given, and it was. And then Jan Matthijs was offside indeed, so those were correct decisions, I think. And then, William Pope and the various defenders getting stuck in all over the place was excellent. According to the official stats, Ulsan had 43 goal attempts in that game.
Mm. Yeah, yes.
I mean, it must be said, and I don't know if Stuart will sort of emphasise it later, but F. Marinos have been suffering badly through injuries, and they were missing Kida, Koto Watanabe. Ryuta Koike is just coming back after literally 1 year out, and I do like him at right back, although Matsubara's doing a fine job. And Elbear was probably, he was missing in this game, wasn't he? I'm losing. Yeah. But Elbear, not even fit again. So, I mean, they've had a bunch of injuries, and they've still, and Eduardo even was on the bench, and of course, he had to come on because Kamijima was sent off. So, Eduardo came on, and I don't think he was 100% either. So, I mean, they're doing it with a lot of injured players, too. And if we move forward to Cerezo later, we'll find more injured players and more rested too. So that's probably how they've managed to put out two teams and two games in the last five or six days. But they've done well, because I think the plans have been upset a lot by all these injuries. I look at it another way and think, to be honest, I thought Muscat, and I think that Kuhl now is also, it's still Postecoglou's team, it's still Ange's team, really. I don't think either of the two managers that have followed Ange have really stamped their way of playing on this team. I think they're still playing for Ange. What do you think, Stuart?
Yeah, I would agree with you there, especially because Harry was and with Angie at Celtic before he came to Marinos, and then when Angie didn't continue, he was just carried on a little and then came to Marinos. So but I think that was part of the decision to bring him over, really, because, like, you know, not having a big change, but in terms of experience, he's got much less experience than Angie has. I don't know how you can compare him and Kevin Muscat too, but he seems like the least experienced of all of the three, and I guess he, well, obviously the youngest too, but I think he's a little bit more pragmatic. I think he probably doesn't go to the extreme doctrine of, you know, playing up until the very last second and trying to score another goal. You know, it'll be a bit more, you know, I see the players a little bit wasting time a little bit more, and I see more shots from outside the box, which been quite successful. I think that was probably not allowed in Angie's the strict Angie doctrine. So but it's very much the same. And I think also the, as you say, the players right now, there's so many players, they just know what to do, and they come in. There's enough players who know the system to basically, you know, like coach and provide a lead for the newer players coming in. And I was saying the other day, we started our university player, and he scored on his second appearance, and he's only 19 years old. So there's new people coming in, and as you say, the injuries have been basically covered by players like stepping up. So yeah, it's very much the same. And also, like, you can see that there's certain really great plays that they make. It's just like fantastic kind of recoveries from, you know, like losing the ball, like even close to the goal in their own half, like within 2 or 3 seconds they can be on the counter way up the field and attacking the goal, and they really know what to do. So I think that's what's carried everybody so far. If you'd had a badly organized team, I think it would have been a disaster so far.
Yeah, indeed. So, well, yeah, no question that Kuehl's had big shoes to fill, following on from Kevin Muscat, who, of course, followed on from Ange Postecoglou. But, Kuehl can now boast that he's done something that neither of his two predecessors could, and that is take F. Marinos to the final of the Asian Champions League. I mean, yeah, some could argue that it's just a natural progression of what Ange Postecoglou started all the way back in 2018. But, yes, Ange Ball Aussie Ball that now is being run under Kuehl has they've made it through all the way to the biggest stage in Asia after a remarkable victory, 5-4 on penalties, as we said, after somehow making it through the 90 minutes and all of extra time. And as Alan said, with over 40 goal attempts from Ulsan. Thanks in large amounts to William Pope and the defence. They've made it through to penalties. Pop almost saved Lee Chung Yong, who went straight down the middle with Ulsan's fourth spot kick, but then did guess right to his left to save poor old Kim Min Woo, who was always a favourite of the podcast in his time at Sagan Tosu. And gee, I wish it had been somebody else who had missed Ulsan's penalty. Obviously, I was wrapped for F. Marinos to make it through, but really felt for Kim Min Woo, such a live wire when he was playing with Sagan. But it was left to Eduardo to score F. Marinos' fifth penalty to send them to a first ever final, where they will face Al Ain of the UAE, who beat Al Hilal of Saudi Arabia 5-4 on aggregate in the West final / the ACL semi-final. The first leg will be at home for F. Marinos at the Nissan Stadium on Saturday, May the 11th, and the second leg is away at 2 weeks later. So obviously we'll preview those Two legs closer to the time, but a remarkable achievement from F. Muddy Nose. And I mean, well, Stuart, it's an obvious question. It's a bit of a lame one, I suppose. But how did you feel when you saw Eduardo's penalty hit the back of the net? You've been following the team for a long time through the ups and downs. Of course, the J1 triumph in 2019, and you saw them win it again under Muscat as well. But did you ever think you'd see F. Muddy Nose make it this far in the Asian Champions League?
Well, not at all, really, because like especially this year we lost a few matches in the, I think in the, one in the group stages, and we didn't do so well, and then we scraped through on several of the matches. It wasn't a clear victory all the way through, not at all. And then, you know, I know Ulsan are a very very good team, so 1-0 away, I thought that was a fair result, that match. And so I was thinking, well, okay, you know, that's possible to you know, recover from, like, just probably, you know, get a draw, a 1-1 draw would probably have been my guess, the final result, if I was optimistic. But 13 minutes, say, like, Uenaka scored, and then, you know, going within 30 minutes to be ahead by two goals, I thought, wow, we can do it. Like, we can do it. We're going to do it. And then, you know, like I say, you know, within another 20 minutes, everything had turned around, and we were hanging on for dear life, and then all the way to penalties. And then I think, okay, penalties, like, you know, okay, we're surely going to lose on penalties. And then, okay, we've had a good run so far, and I don't, everybody will be happy that we got this far. But amazingly, it was quite an easy penalty shootout. You know, like, we've seen Marinos you know, go to like about 20 penalties at some shootouts in the past. So I was really, really happy, really. The roar was incredible. Like, if you listen back to that last minute, and I'm quite calm in these these situations, but I just felt, you know, okay, wow, that's an amazing sight, and I was glad I was there. And there've been so many matches in the rain at Nissan Stadium this year, so it was another like soaking. I stood in the rain for the whole of the match with my poncho on. It wasn't cold, but it was definitely, I'll never forget that night.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. And then, well, as we said, the players, the staff and the supporters had to, a couple of days to recover, and then to get down to Osaka for a meeting with Cerezo, who were, looking to bounce back after they were ambushed by Nagoya in their first defeat of the season last weekend. But one of five players that kept his spot in the starting lineup from Wednesday night to Saturday was Asahi Wainaka. And sorry, guys, you said before that Elber had just come back. He actually did start both of these games as well. Wainaka caught Kakeru Funaki napping and picked his pocket in the Cerezo box in the 17th minute, poked the ball to Elber. And after taking a touch, Elber's cross was a pinpoint onto the noggin of Kota Mizunuma, who glanced in a header to give F. Muddy Nose the lead. But then in a pretty hectic ending to the first half, in the 45th minute, William Pope upended Leo Ciara, the referee pointing to the penalty spot. But Ciara stepped up and missed his penalty wide to the left. But before half time, Cerezo did manage to equalize. In the 8th minute of stoppage time, Shinji Kagawa pounced on a heavy Namtehi touch, and Satoshi Tanaka swept the ball over to Ciara, whose quick feet saw him finish smartly and score for the fifth straight game. So, obviously, you know all about Leo Ciara, Stuart. You saw him with F. Muddy Nose. He came into the country as an F. Muddy Nose player. But I tell you what, Alan, he's in a similar vein of form to Rio Germain, isn't he, with the way he's been so prolific in the early days of this season?
I think he had to be. I think, and I think I might have mentioned this way back at the start of the season, if I was on the pod then, that basically Cerezo seemed to be lacking an actual striker. They've just got the one striker, then they've got five, six, seven choices of a support striker, but Leo Sierra is the only one that they really have who I think they can, you know, they can rely on to score goals. So he has to do it. As long as he keeps doing it, they won't complain too much because they've got plenty of supporting cast who can attack well. Although I believe they've just lost Kapik Zaba yesterday, yesterday as we're recording, who pulled a muscle in some kind yesterday, and I believe he's out for a month from what I've heard. So it's going to be an upset for the Ceres or Osaka fans. But yeah, as long as Leo keeps doing it and doesn't miss too many more penalties, they should be fine. And they seem to have a very settled team, almost unchanged for most of the season, actually. So interesting to see what they do, especially when Nishio comes back from the under-23s and Kagawa is actually back from injury and did start. Although I do like Shibayama, I think he's.
Yeah.
I do like him a lot, and he's quite young and ready to play. So, I mean they've got Jordy Crooks on, shall we say, reserve, because they have too many foreign players registered at the moment. So, I mean, they can have as many as they want, of course, this season, but they can't have more than five in the matchday squad, I think. So, since even the goalkeeper, second goalkeeper, Wang, is not on the bench either, because they've got so many foreign players lined up. So, but back to Leo Sierra. Yes, I think keep it up and it'll be fine. And Stuart was there, so over to you, Stuart, perhaps.
Yes, but also don't forget that Leo Sierra played for FC Ryukyu in 2016 under a different name, I think. I forget his name in Ryukyu.
Was it under the name of Emerson with a Qatari passport?
I don't know, but it was one of those Brazilians who maybe didn't do so well and then comes back under a different name and makes it all better. Yeah, I like, obviously for Marinos fans, the funny thing was that when the players were announced, there was a huge clap from the Cerezo supporters for Kota Mizunuma. also of FC Tokyo fame. And so then it was like I turned to my friends and I said, are we clapping Leo Sierra? And I think, yeah, so we better clap him now that they've done the nice one and clapped Kota Mizunuma. So there was a very polite clap for Leo Sierra, but like the howls from our side when he missed a penalty were to be heard. Like it was like the animals at the zoo had all, you know, escaped at that point. And I think maybe just the disappointment and the embarrassment of missing the penalty fired him up to score the next goal. So, you know, there you go. Yeah, but, you know, it was, a tough match. I really would have obviously preferred that if we'd won the match, especially after traveling to go and see it. It's always happy to take the points back, but I think it was a fair score. And also, like, we're very, very aware, like, with the league table, that how much the match meant to Cerezo to actually win that match. So it was a really, like, they had all the motivation in the world, like, not to give up at any point and to really even defend the draw to the final second. There's everything to win for both teams, basically. And they had so many, like, you know, almost double the shots on goal that Marinos have. Well, one thing I've noticed for almost every match, Marinos have had 60% possession against 40% possession on like all the matches, but maybe not so many shots on goal as you know, other teams in their 40s. But glad not to lose, I think was the final verdict on that one.
I mean, the entire squad must have just been running on fumes. So, yeah, as I said, the fact that they were able to give Cerezo a game and indeed take the lead twice. They led a game just before the hour through Keigo Sakakibara. He's the first J1 goal, put F. Marinos 2-1 up. But, that man, Leo Sierra, got his second of the afternoon in the 68th minute when he headed in a Lucas Fernandez free kick. Pop got a hand to it but could not keep it out. late drama. The substitute Anderson Lopez headed wide for F. Marinos in the last 5 minutes. And then in the second minute of stoppage time, Pope got down to make a terrific save from Seiya Maikuma's drive from 25 yards. But yes, at the end of the day, it finished 2-2. And that result actually saw Cerezo move back to the top of the table. Goal difference ahead of Machida on a weekend where, so many of the teams in the top half of the table failed to win. Cerezo moved up to the top of the pile, as I said, on goal difference. F. Marinos very comfortably placed after 10 rounds. Of course, they've only played 9 games. They play their game in hand against Kashiwa at home at the end of May. So, terrific to catch up with you, Stuart, and hear all about last Wednesday night. The weather obviously didn't cooperate, but you got to see an amazing game of football, and for your team to come out on the right end of it and end up in a continental final is remarkable turn of events. So thanks again for joining us, and I hope to speak to you again either before or after the first leg of the ACL final, because that's obviously going to be a huge occasion for you as well, as he says in a massive understatement. So we look forward to catching up with you then, and good luck to F. Marinos in the meantime.
Well, thank you very much. I'll be happy to join next time, and I'll be supporting all the way.
All right, and thanks once again to Stuart, and what a few days it has been for all F. Marinos supporters, no question about that. All right then, so the other half of Osaka was also at home in match day 10 with the Gamba hosting fellow original 10 side Kashima. Gamba had surged up to sixth after back-to-back wins, while visiting Antlers were mid-table after losing 3 of their last 4 in the league. But of course, Gamba were coming off that midweek defeat away at FC Ryukyu, although it must be said almost the entire first team squad was left at home. But wrapping up a pretty ordinary week for the black and blue half of Osaka. Alan, they slumped to a 2-1 defeat to visiting Antlers in a game that is always keenly contested with a bit of niggle. Antlers were, both of their goals were initially disallowed by the linesman, weren't they? But they were very thankful that VAR was around to allow them their 2 goals that ended up being enough to see them pass Gamba.
I think this game showed how close a game can be. I mean, VAR, good or bad, and I'm sure most of us think it's bad. I'm sure Antlers fans will think it's pretty good at the moment. But both of their goals were inches onside, and Gamba's goal was could have been. It was almost out. It was an interesting one as well. In fact, the surprising for me, I was watching it live at the time, and Welton went down in the penalty area, and I thought, get up, you Wally. And he did. He got up immediately, unlike any Brazilian I've ever known. He went down, he bounced up and got the ball and did a Mitoma. I mean, was it out? Was it out? And it wasn't. It was slightly just in. And he got it across, and the ball was slipped into the corner. So, I mean, all 3 goals were very close, and it was the kind of thing that, the game, it's like so many things that happen, it's just by inches, and isn't it? It's the beautiful game, it's the wonderful game. So Sakamoto got, I think, his 3rd goal in a row, three games in a row for Sakamoto at Gamba. They've had a lot of injuries this season. They're missing various players at various times, but it's good to see at least that Usami is back after probably a year and a half of injury woes and out of form. So Usami is back and leading the team, but in this case, I think both teams were not that good, to be honest. It wasn't the best game to watch, but Antlers came out of it in the end. I would say fortunate for the win, but I think if Gamba had got a point out of it, they would have been fortunate too. So a bad week for Gamba. Hopefully they can get it behind them. Only about 20 points left for safety.
indeed. So just quickly running through the goals from this one. In the 27th minute, a long diagonal from Kashima's Keichinen was chested down and finished smartly by Hayato Nakama, who had ghosted into the box in behind Takeru Kishimoto. The goal was disallowed by the linesman, but given onside by VAR. Then 6 minutes before the break, Issa Sakamoto, as Alan said, scored for the third straight game. A long diagonal from Darwin was brought down superbly by Welton, who rode a challenge from Corky Unzai and, yes, got to his feet quickly and crossed just before the ball crossed the byline. Sakamoto side-footing home first time. But 9 minutes into the second half, Nakama turned provider. He sent an in-swinging cross in from the left. It skimmed off a Gumba defender's head, squirmed under Yuma Suzuki's boot and was tapped in at the back post by the suddenly prolific Kimito Nono, who matched Sakamoto with a goal in his third straight game as well. So yeah, an important victory for Antlers. They all are at this stage of the season, and yeah, it saw them rise up the table to fifth. And indeed, at the start of the match day, of the teams in the top half of the table, only Kashima and FC Tokyo were winners in match day 10. It was one of those weeks for almost all of the other teams in the top half of the table. All right, Alan, so you said you watched Gumba and Kashima live on Sunday afternoon, but I know you were at the Noivir Stadium on Saturday for Kobe hosting Kyoto. These are Kansai rivals, very much positioned at either end of the table heading into this game. Defending champions Kobe up in the top six, as most of us expected they would be, and they hosted joint bottom Kyoto. As I say, one of those weekends for a number of teams in the top half of the table, and we can certainly add Kobe to that list of teams, Alan, in a game where, depending on whose stats you believe, it was either 29 shots to 5 or 35 shots to 8. Kobe just could not find a way past Gu Sung Yun, and somehow or another, Kyoto have escaped the Noivir Stadium with all 3 points after a 1-0 away win.
Yep, it was indeed one of those days. Vissel were probably as full strength as they can be at the moment. They've pretty much been unchanged for most of the season. And they've got plenty of players in reserve as well. You know, Yuriki came back on later in the game after a long injury. I hear Kikuchi's back next week again, but he won't be starting. So, I mean, they've got plenty of players around, and they threw a few on to try and change things around. But Gu was excellent, including a saved PK, of course. Mm. It was one of those days. I mean, as you said, there was like 30 attempts on goal, at least for Vissel Kobe. And nothing. There weren't really any complaints from the Vissel players at the end, of course, except apart from the fact that they didn't win. I think that what we remember most from this game is the VAR. And I had people asking me what's going on at Vissel because some of them weren't watching the game. Did you actually manage to watch the game, or should I run through what happened in the VAR just before halftime?
Yeah, go for it.
Well, Osako scored a goal, we thought. Well worked, little pass through the middle, back into the middle, and slipped past the keeper. And it was literally 5 minutes with the referee standing around in the middle. And I don't know if it's a new policy or not, but he wasn't standing there with his hand on his ear and his arm out. So nobody really knew what was going on for the first minute or so. And it turns out, and then I was about 5 yards away from the referee assessor who had a TV screen and was assessing the referee at the time. So I went over and had a look at with him, and we discussed it. And it turned out that it's, you know, Osako's kneecap appeared to be offside. Another one of those inches between a goal and no goal. So about 5 minutes later, the goal was not given. The ball went back to the goalkeeper, ready for the goal kick, and then the referee holds it up again. And this time they're looking for a handball, which, and I said to the referee assessor right next to me now, like, why wasn't this looked at the same time? Mm. And it was ridiculous, because then just about to start, and then, oh, it's a handball as well. And they looked at it, and it was one of those that no way was it intentional. But at the current law states, the ball brushed the guy's arm.
Sorry to interrupt. This is when Miyashiro jumped with the Kyoto defender, and the ball ended up at Osaka's feet, and he swept in.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right. Okay.
You know, Miyashiro jumped up, and it sort of went over the, I don't know, brushed the, it was nothing. I mean, but no, at the current rate of exchange, I was going to say, I've got money on my mind. Laws in place. It was a handball. I hate them, but they have to be given. Because, and then, well, it was about 3 minutes for that. So I think we had about 8 or 9 minutes of And it was really quite funny in the stadium, because they were showing the handball and they were showing what the VAR could see, which I think is a good thing. And so the game was going back and forwards, and the ball would move forward again, and then it would touch the guy's arm, and the crowd would get into it, because every time it moved, they were going, whoa. And then when Osako put the ball in the net, for about 3 minutes, they were boo and cheering the goals, which of course didn't come. And eventually, after 8 or 9 minutes, PK was given, which was promptly saved very well by Gu in goal. Mm. It was right in the corner, right by the post, but he guessed the right way and he put his hand to it and saved it. So he gave them the game in the end. So yep, VAR was the star in this game, unfortunately.
Well, I appreciate the clarity there, because in the about 8.5 to 9 minute highlights package for the DAZN Japan YouTube channel I watched today, Alan, I saw Osako score the goal in the first minute of first half stoppage time. I saw the referee getting the word from VAR in his ear, disallow it with how many minutes have ticked over on the clock at that point. But then the very next action I saw was Osako standing over a penalty in the 12th minute of the stoppage time, and I'd wondered what on earth had happened. So thank you for the clarity, and obviously a terrific save by Gu, and it obviously just wasn't Yuya Osako's day. And after 15 minutes of the stoppage time were played, the teams finally headed to the sheds for some oranges. 7 minutes after the break, Kyoto's Taichi Hara had one of Kyoto's few opportunities on the afternoon. He shot at the end of a counterattack, but it was blocked by a sliding Tetsushi Yamakawa. But 4 minutes after that, a bullet header from Hara from a corner in from the Kyoto right was ultimately all that Kyoto needed to claim a famous victory for them over the defending champions. And just like Tosu did last week, the win has seen them haul themselves off the foot of the table. Well, they weren't 20th and bottom, of course. They were goal difference ahead of Sapporo heading into the match day. But yes, they are now no longer joint bottom, let's put it that way, after 10 rounds. And, a much needed victory, to put it mildly, for Sanga. And speaking of teams at the bottom of the table, Alan, let's segue over to the Sapporo Dome in the game that kicked off the match day at Saturday lunchtime. It was the other two teams that came into the match day level, with Kyoto on 6 points, hosts Consadole and visiting Shonan Bellmare. And, it's not quite accurate to call this a game of two halves, Alan, but after Sapporo raced into a 3-0 lead, Shonan showed tremendous fighting spirit to come all the way back and earn a draw. They scored their third goal, their equaliser, in second half stoppage time. So, a massive point on the road for Shonan, but yet another disappointing result for Sapporo, especially after they'd gotten themselves into cruise control, it appeared, a 3-0 up in this game.
Yeah, they don't seem to be able to hold a lead, do they? But this is Sapporo. They score goals, they concede goals, and that's the way it is. But 3-0 up, the first half, some of the passing moves and the running, and there were like five players available for a pass. They were playing extremely well. And Bellmare were just not getting up with them either. And Aoki scored a couple of nice goals, the second one in the ninth minute of the second half. But he took his chances. One was like, 25-yard shot or so. And Ando playing sort of left wing, left midfield, in from Yokohama FC last year, has settled in nicely there. So it's interesting, because I think last year Consadole seemed to have 18 or 20 players that they could rotate in and out, and you never knew who was really going to play. And of course, most of them can play different positions as well. But this year they've probably only got 12 or 13 or 14 players to choose from. And then they've got a lot of young kids who are coming in and out. So once they get injuries, like I think they had a couple of players out this game, they sort of seem to lose track, and they haven't, they need a captain on the field. Or Petrovic is not the kind of guy to run around on the touchline or run around at all and shouting.
He can't, can he? Yeah.
because I'm not going to stand for it. In fact, he will. He's they're not really getting any guidance once they're out in a 3-0 lead. So, but I think basically that they tired a little and Belmare came into it. And I presume you're going to describe the goals a little bit, so I won't go into that too much. But Belmare did their goals well, and they weren't really like superb passes and wonderful shots. They were just hard work and close to the goal line finishes. So I think in this case, Sapporo were unlucky again, but most people will look at it and say they bottled it and gave up a 3-0 lead.
Yeah, obviously a really disappointing one for Sapporo after it. Yeah, it did appear it should have been a game set match, as you say, after Ryota Aoki's the second of the afternoon, 9 minutes into the second half, made it 3-0. Yes, he'd given the host the lead in the 23rd minute. And then, yeah, just before the break, Tomoki Kondo headed in his first Sapporo goal. But 57 seconds after coming on, Shonan sub Taiga Hata began the Belmare comeback in the 67th minute. Side footing in Lukian's square pass. Then with 5 minutes left, another Shonan sub, Shaw Fukuda, made it 3-2 with a brave diving header after the ball was nodded into his path by Kazuki Oiwa. And with Sapporo bums squeaking all over the Sapporo Dome, Shonan snatched a 93rd minute equaliser. Yuto Suzuki chesting down and firing in from 6 yards after a corner was flicked on. So, yeah, a really difficult one for Sapporo to take, but to Shonan, a battling point. And so, yeah, at the end of the match day, these two teams have now been obviously left in Kyoto's dust, but they are joint bottom with 7 points from 10 games. Kind of trying to segue on to the next game, Alan, with I guess one team that most of us expected to struggle in and around the bottom three, but it hasn't quite been the case so far for Jubilo Iwata. On Saturday, they hosted leaders Machida. Machida obviously coming off that victory in the Tokyo Derby against FC Tokyo. Controversy tinged through my red and blue glasses anyway. But yes, Machida were on their way to Shizuoka, and they had to try and contain runaway Golden Boot leader Rio Germain. More on him in a second. 49 seconds into the second half, Iwata took the lead through an unlikely source. Their left back, Kou Matsubara, who was starting for the first time in 4 games, he fired in superbly after Rikosi Tani had saved from Masaya Matsumoto. Matsumoto set up by a through ball from Germain. Then in the 66th minute, Ricardo Grass's header from a corner after it was flicked on in the centre hit Gen Shoji's arm, and the penalty was given after a VAR check. And that man, Germain, stood over the penalty in the 70th minute and beat Tani pretty easily for his 10th goal of the season. And to get there in the 10th round is a pretty remarkable achievement. And coming from a much maligned player like Germain, well, yeah, you just have to doff your cap to him and say that he's been absolutely terrific so far this season. Alan, I'm sure you've seen this incident, and I don't have any qualms at all about the ball hitting Gen Shoji's arm, especially after the way he was chirping to the referee last week, let's say, in the FC Tokyo game. But I just had a quick check on the rules there for this. The Iwata player Riku Morioka was offside in between Shoji and Tani. I presume that just doesn't have anything to do with the play. The fact that Grasset headed the ball and Morioka was offside, that doesn't factor into to VAR's decision at all. It's just the fact that it's hit Shoji's arm.
They seem to change their minds depending on the, you know, what the player is doing behind them, which I guess is logical. I mean, the fact is that the ball didn't reach him. The ball didn't look like it was going to reach him. So they presume that he's not offside. He's not interfering with play. As I think Bill Shankly said in the 60s, if you're on the pitch, you're interfering with play. But, you know, these are the rules these days. It was a tough one. It could have gone either way. We've seen goals. I mean, let's put it this way. If he was standing offside and the ball went through his legs from a shot, that's given offside these days. So
right.
reasonably logical to what they're doing. And for me, I'm actually thinking that according to the laws of the game, VAR gets most things right, or even let's say all things right. It's just that they take so long to do it these days. I mean, it's getting a bit ridiculous, but VAR is there to make sure that things go right. I mean, let's face it, both Antler's goals, for example, were given offside, and they weren't offside by a whisker or a thumb or a toe, but they were the correct decisions. It just takes so long to make them. So some of the complaints that we're making about VAR are probably going in the wrong direction. I mean, VAR is there and making things right, but it's just taking it too long. So I've digressed a little, but it's time for us to improve VAR a little bit more, but keep the decisions coming. And Shoji, yes, I mean, another one of those where I wouldn't have given it a few years ago myself, certainly not an intentional handball, but it did brush his arm, and there was no complaints from Shoji himself when it was given. And on to Jermaine. Wow, amazing, eh?
Well, yeah. I mean, what can you put it down to? Just, he got a couple early doors, and just appears to be a massive confidence player. That remarkable game against Kawasaki has seemed to just stand him in good stead for basically each and every game since then.
Yeah, I think, as you say, it's a confidence thing. It's the right place at the right time, but that is the mark of a good player. And the fact that he does have, three or four or five penalties in there as well. Mm. So making the most of them. But 2017 or 18, whatever it was, the Universiade Games where he played there. And I mean, he was an excellent player. He was looking good. And then he sort of dropped away. And then, of course, he was stuck in J2 for a couple of seasons as well. Yokohama FC didn't do so well there, if I remember correctly. That was the team he was with, right? So, he's come back. And I don't think any of us expected him. To be honest, the way he's playing, I'm looking at it, and the fact that it's Jubilo, I don't expect it to continue either. I don't think he'll be heading for the top scorers by the end of the season. But good luck to him. And if I'm wrong, well, so be it.
Yeah, a remarkable start to the season, no question, for Rio Jermaine. And, Jubilo defying expectations up in 12th after 10 rounds of the season. So, OK, with that game reviewed, we're officially halfway through the match day 10 review. So we'll take another quick break and be back with the remaining five games in just a moment. Yes, welcome back. So five games to review, and we'll begin this part of the podcast down in Hiroshima, where Sanfrecce hosted Kawasaki Frontale on Sunday afternoon, a beautiful afternoon down at the Edeon Peace Wing, Hiroshima, Alan. And on this occasion, these teams ended up with a point apiece after a 2-2 draw. Once again, I think Hiroshima finishing a game, frustrated at the number of opportunities they've had, but they have not been able to turn them into enough goals to claim all 3 points on the afternoon. And Kawasaki, I guess, have left with some credit as they tried to haul themselves up the table. Obviously a difficult away day for them, and the fact that they were able to score twice, I guess, bodes well for them going forward. But one of those days where I think both teams have some frustration, but ultimately maybe a draw was just about the right result.
Yeah, I think so. I think the unlikely hero of the day was the Kawasaki Frontale goalkeeper, Kami Fukumoto, who was actually the unlikely goalkeeper because apparently Jung was injured in the warm-up. He stayed on the bench, Jung, because I guess they hadn't brought a third goalkeeper with them. But Jung Sung-ryong was apparently lined up to play and got injured in the warm-up. So Kami Fukumoto came in, and he probably made four or five quite decent saves to keep them in the game. So in the end, a fair result. And I'm sure we've got a couple of things we can discuss too, right?
Most definitely. Yes, so we're 7 minutes before halftime. Hiroshima's Yuki Ohashi rose above Asahi Sasaki to head in a Sho Sasaki cross for his seventh of the season. And just before the break, Taishi Matsumoto's shot came back off the bar for the hosts as they look to go and double their advantage before the break. But it was just a 1-0 to Sanfrecce at halftime at the break. Frontale boss Toru Oniki brought on veteran striker Yu Kobayashi, and 20 minutes into the second half, Kobayashi scored from a tight angle. Kobayashi was then taken off in the 74th minute, so just about a 30-minute cameo for him. And his replacement, Shin Yamada, scored with his first touch seconds later to give Frontale a 2-1 lead. A poor clearance from the Hiroshima goalkeeper Keisuke Osako sent the ball straight up into the air. Akihiro Iyanaga nudged Sho Sasaki to the floor and then pulled the ball back for Yamada. I know that Cesare Pellegrini was up in arms about the fact that this goal was allowed to stand in our line group, Alan, and obviously Cesare has Hiroshima leanings. I was quite surprised to see you go into bat for Cesare. It's quite unusual to see you two agree with each other, but I think you agreed that Iyanaga had used enough force for this to be considered a push and rather than just a nudge, and you were surprised that the goal was allowed to stand yourself. Having watched it back again, are you still of the same opinion?
I'm less sure that it was found out, but at the time, I was watching it on three TVs, or you know, three devices, and DAZN with a split screen, and I had all sorts of games going on at the same time. And I sort of saw the goal go in there, and I flicked over to that one, and I saw the push in the back, and I was like, okay, that's not a goal. And then I went back to watch other games, and then I noticed that the goal had been given. And to me, the first reaction was certainly that it was definitely a foul. So I watched the replay today before we came on the air, and I still think it's a foul. And however small a foul is, it's a foul. You know, they say a player goes down easily, or it was only a small tug of the shirt, or whatever, etc. And depends on the field, you know, the area of the field. No, it does not depend on the severity of the foul. It does not depend on the area of the field. A foul is a foul. And to me, I had a closer look, and it was Iyanaga's shoulder, but it wasn't Sasaki's shoulder. So it wasn't shoulder to shoulder. So it wasn't a shoulder charge. Iyanaga, on second look, didn't go in as hard as I thought he did. And Sasaki went over a lot easier than he should have done. And I think, as I said, I do believe it was a foul. A foul is a foul. But I think that Sasaki went down, made a meal of it, realized while he was going down that he's probably not shouldn't have been making a meal of it, and got immediately back up again and almost got back to the ball. So I wonder if he could have stayed on his feet and done a better job. But in the end, I still agree that, you know, it was a foul to me. It wasn't a shoulder to shoulder. It was enough of a nudge to send the player down and create the if we're going to give accidental handballs that come off a player's elbow, then that was definitely a foul for me.
Yeah, it is a tricky one. I can see both sides of it. Obviously, Naoya Kanai was batting the Kawasaki corner in support of Iyanaga, and saying that the contact was minimal. You can see that Iyanaga definitely does take a glance to see where Sasaki is. I mean, you know, he's entitled to do that. Otherwise, he might, you know, run into Sasaki's elbow or something like that. But I mean, you can definitely see what Iyanaga, I think, is shaping to do when he looks at Sasaki and obviously glances up at the ball as well. He knows that. I guess his best chance of winning the ball is to nudge Sasaki under it. So he does that, and I guess he runs the risk of the referee blowing for a foul, or indeed VAR picking up on it later on, maybe in 7 or 8 or 8 or 9 instances of a similar type, you would see the attacking player penalised. But in this case, I guess he, inverted commas, got away with one. And Yamada got his goal. But Sanfrecce were only behind for approximately 73 seconds. Mutsuki Kato half-volleying in his first league goal of the season from a lovely chipped Makoto Mitsuta ball into the box. And yes, from there, the two sides finished up, as we said, 2-2 this game finished. And you might have noticed, listeners, we usually do save draws for the end of the episode. Of course, we're always going to talk about the Cerezo F. Marinos draw with Stuart in part two. But yes, we've also chatted about the draw at the foot of the table between Sapporo and Shonan, and this one as well up at the sharper end of the table, at least where Hiroshima are concerned, because yes, they did have a chance to go clear at the top of the table, Sanfrecce, had they won on Sunday after both Machida and Cerezo dropped points on Saturday. But as it was, yes, Frontale were dogged visitors and left with a point. And as it is, yes, Hiroshima third in the table after 10 match days. The next couple of games we'll come on to were one. And on Sunday, Urawa hosted Nagoya at Saitama Stadium. This was, just like Gamba and Kashima, a matchup of original 10 teams. These teams came in contrasting form. Reds were losers of 3 of their last 4 in the league, while Grampus had won 5 in a 6-game unbeaten run. But yes, as we've said earlier, in a match day when nothing quite went for the teams in the top half of the table, Grampus, who came in 5th, they left disappointed after a 2-1 defeat. Reds took the lead through Kaito Yasui in the 24th minute. He pounced after a Grampus defender sliced an attempted clearance straight up into the air, and Tiago Santana's attempted pass into Yasui's path was helped there by another Grampus defender. Then 5 minutes into the second half, Ryuji Izumi spurned a great chance to equalize at the end of a fine Grampus build-up. And with 20 minutes left, Reds made it 2-0 from the spot through Tiago Santana after Risho Inagaki fouled Naoki Maeda. In the second of 5 minutes added on at the end of the second half, Izumi volleyed in after Shusaku Nishikawa had saved a Kennedy Egbus Mikuni header. But that was just a consolation for Grampus. And Reds were back to winning ways, Alan. It's been definitely an up and down start to their season under Mr. Hugmo, hasn't it? But maybe this victory could be just what they needed to kickstart their season.
Who knows? I'm not sure they know what they're doing, to be honest. Mr. Hugmo Lukatil, I can speak a little Norwegian for him. Good luck to him. I'm not sure he's really knows his best team yet. They've also had some problems with injuries, but while Schultz was out for about a month, Yota Sato came in, and I really like him, and I don't think he did anything wrong while he was out, so there was no problem there. Hiroki Sakai was right back. He's also injured right now, but I also like Ishihara, who came in from Shonan Bellmare. He's an excellent player too. So they've had their injuries, but they've got plenty of players to cover them, and they've got so much attacking choices. I mean, that players like Ekenit has hardly had a look in this season, the Thai star, and Matsuo, Yusuke Matsuo, is in and out. And of course, they have Kuroki to throw in on the last 20 minutes as well now and again. So they got plenty of forwards to play with, and Santana seems to be hitting his stride a little after a very slow start. I'm not sure if it's a managerial thing or the players are not knowing each other that well, but they don't seem to be a team as much as they could be anyway, for sure. A win like this, I think the stats will show that Nagoya Grampus were probably twice as many shots and at least 60% of the play, I expect, and they seem to be good. But Urawa did what was necessary. They pounced on the one goal, and they scored the penalty of the kick from the other one. So it may be a fortunate win in the end, but it all helps. And they have the players. Now, do they have the manager to make the team? Because Nagoya was the team that we all, I think they started with 3 straight defeats, I believe. And that was the team that everybody was like, the manager's going to get fired, and Kent Hasegawa is failing miserably. And then, as you said, they won 5 out of 6, I think. So, it's amazing, Jay, isn't it? Anything can happen. Sometimes it's down to the manager, but a lot of times it's down to the players on the pitch. And if they can find their stride and become a better team, it's going to work well for them. I think Shoya Nakajima has hardly really played, and he started in this game. He also didn't he start in the week? I think he scored two goals in the Levant Cup as well. So, so that's nice. And the manager has been experimenting a little because Gustafsson is obviously is basically the single central defensive midfield player that they're using right now. But Ito Atsuki is also a defensive minded midfield player, and then they were using Ken Iwao, who again is also a defensive minded midfield player. So at times they were playing 4-3-3, but all three of their midfielders are sort of defensive minded. So when they've brought on an extra forward, like they've put Nakajima or Matsuo in that extra midfield place, or in this case Yasui, and I think they're sort of playing a 4-1-2-3 as opposed to a 4-2-1-3 or even a 4-3-3. So the manager's mixing it up a little bit, and I think he's finding out which players are best. And there's plenty of players that are playing for their places. I mean, Nakajima is by no means an automatic choice, but he's an excellent player when he's on form. FC Tokyo background, of course, so you'll know him. I think I don't think they're going to be struggling against relegation, shall we say. But will they be up there at the top three or four at the end? I'm not sure, so.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've just come out of a, as we said, a patchy run of form where they came in having lost three of their last four. But yes, this victory and obviously the results that went above them in the match day have seen them end it just 5 points off top spot. So, obviously a big logjam of teams. All the way down the table, pretty much. But yeah, this result could be just what Mr. Hegmo needs to get his season up and running. I mean, as we've said in the last couple of years, Reds have chopped and changed managers, which is obviously can't be good for the continuity of the playing group either. And so he's still trying, I think, to bed in his ideas and, as you say, Alan, get players back from injury and find out his favoured personnel. So, obviously we won't see the best of Reds for another month or two yet, I would wager. All right, next we'll move up to the Big Swan, which hosted the very definition of a mid-table battle on Saturday. 10th-placed FC Tokyo travelled up to face 11th-placed Niigata, with the teams level on 12 points, 7 points behind Machida and 6 above the bottom three at kickoff. Of course, but Tokyo have returned to the capital with all 3 points after a touch wood. I don't want to be too cocky, but a pretty comfortable 3-1 away victory here, Alan. I think the early exchanges were fairly even, but once Teruhito Nakagawa had steered in a Kosuke Shirai cross at the end of a lightning fast Tokyo counter 6 minutes before the break, there was really only ever going to be one winner. 4 minutes into the second half, Nakagawa returned the favour, teeing up Shirai for a crisp drive from inside the D for 2-0 that went through the legs of a Niigata defender, Kazuhiko Chiba. And I think, wrong-footed or wrong-sighted, the keeper, Ryosuke Kojima, maybe a shot he would love to see again, but he was unable to keep it out. But for Shirai, it's a terrific reward for a... a breakout few weeks, actually, for him. I think he definitely had his doubters when he came in from Kyoto, but he's been excellent, as I say, especially in the last few weeks. And the returning Diego Oliveira, we'd all been wondering where he'd been for the last month or so. He actually was called into duty, I think, earlier than Peter Klimovsky had intended. He didn't start this game, but he had to come on in the first 20 minutes when Tsubasa Terayama was forced off injured. But Oliveira got to Tokyo's third goal in the 62nd minute, heading in a lobbed Kei Koizumi cross. And at 3-0, it was a pretty much game set match. There was a consolation for Niigata in the 90th minute of Fumiya Hayakawa's header. Lessened the blow somewhat for the Niigata supporters. But 3-1 was, dare I say it, Alan, pretty comprehensive from Tokyo.
Total 100% luck. Yeah. No, I think it was probably in the end more than they deserved. I mean, Albirex weren't that bad, and I think outshot and probably outpossessed FC Tokyo. But FC Tokyo took the chances. They were fast on the break. And I think Diego Oliveira should be given some great credit for the first goal, where The ball was cleared from the defence and shot up to the halfway line. Diego just flicked it to the side where I believe it was Shirai running down the wing there.
Yep.
And then like three or four players that played with the ball, and it was so quickly. And then the cross whipped in and Nakadao just slid in. And it was like, it was five or six seconds from area to area. But that little flick from Diego Oliveira was one that made it. And then afterwards, you could see him running down as fast as he could to try and get there. I mean, he was well behind the play, but the fact that he was running like hell to try and get there, it was interesting. I've discussed with people, perhaps even you, I'm not sure, I can't remember who I talked to about football. I just talk to anybody that listens. But I think that FC Tokyo have been playing much better without Diego Oliveira. I think they seem to, I mean, the likes of Tawara Tsumida, Anzai, have been coming in and filling in nicely. Of course, they have Araki is missing with the under-23s right now, so he's away too. So they have those sort of playing with a false nine, for want of a better word, and all those quite young players and quite fast players who are willing to run around and rotate at the top. And I'm not sure Oliveira will really fit into that system. So I wonder if he'll actually be a super sub for the rest of the season or not, or whether he'll manage to come in with a half assist, a hockey assist, I think they might call this, and a goal. Whether he earns a place to start again. I think they will probably do better without him. Of course, Ogashiwa is also there, but unfortunately he got injured again last week.
Yeah.
Or if he'll be back again for another few weeks or whatever. But so many good players to play with. And I think that Peter Klimovsky is finally getting a team, because, I mean, he's tried this with Espos and Montedeo Yamagata and never quite got there. And I think he's got a team that is close to playing how he wants to. The fact that Shirai was up and down the field all the time. He's got Takahiro Ko in the middle, who was basically come in, and I presumed that he was going to replace Matsuki when Matsuki went to Europe, but he was already playing in the middle when Matsuki was still playing as well. Mm. And he I remember watching him in the J3 with Gamba under 23s a long time ago, and he's been out and about, and he's back in J1, which is nice. And he's blooding Doi at centre back, and Morishige is stuck on the bench. And of course, Shirai is basically, and Bangnagande is not exactly a pensioner yet. They're keeping Nagatomo on the bench too. So I think the fact that the team is getting younger and faster and fitter. Are you optimistic? I'm sort of watching from the outside, but they're looking very good. They're looking improved, and things could go very well for them. Is it going to be a confidence thing? Is it going to be down to the manager now? What do you think, Mr.
Yeah.
FC?
Yeah, it's I agree that signs are generally positive. We've certainly seen that they're still capable of throwing in a rank performance here or there, but I guess that's to be expected. You can definitely see Klimovsky is putting his stamp on the team as a whole by, as you said, phasing out Morishige and Nagatomo, and yeah, I imagine he will be doing the same with Diego Oliveira as well. But obviously can see, you know, the merits to having a player like Diego on the bench, because he's obviously vastly experienced, and he does offer hold up play, and his finishing in the box, I think, is probably the best of anyone in this squad. But yeah, you can see in terms of general play and the way that Tokyo want to counter attack, then Diego is perhaps not the best suited for that. But as I say, he certainly does still have a role in this squad. And yeah, the young players coming through are generally all very exciting, and I think it does bode well. In a similar position to where Urawa are after 10 games, that Tokyo are 4 points off the top. And yeah, obviously at this stage of proceedings, you're happy to be in that sort of in shouting distance of the real sharp end of the table. And yeah, as things we hope will continue to progress throughout the season, I'd say Tokyo are decently placed at the moment without getting too carried away. But that was definitely a very positive result to get away at Niigata on Saturday afternoon. And with that game taken care of, we'll finish the roundup of J1 Matchday 10 with the other two draws from the match day that both took place on Sunday at Hitachi Dai. Kashiwa hosted Tosu, and that game finished 1-1. In the 14th minute, visiting Sagan took the lead when Saul Kawahara took a free kick from deep on the right, and Marcelo Gian leapt and sent a looping header well out of Kenta Matsumoto's reach for 1-0. But 5 minutes before the break, Takuya Shimamura met Matias Savio's cutback at the near post. Park Il-gyu saved, but Shimamura fired the loose ball home. And finally, Alan, at the Ajinomoto Stadium on Sunday afternoon, Tokyo Verde hosted Fukuoka, and this game finished goalless. There were some decent chances at either end, and then a huge one for hosts Verde, but ultimately this game ended in a stalemate. In the 20th minute, Yudai Kimura's point-blank header was tipped onto the bar by Fukuoka keeper Masaaki Murakami. Then 10 minutes into the second half, Fukuoka defender Douglas Grolley saw his blast parried away at close range by Mateus. And then there were 5 minutes of stoppage time posted, but in the sixth of those, Fukuoka had a corner. Verde countered, were allowed to take the ball down the pitch by the referee, and it ended with Thiago Alves one-on-one with Murakami. His shot was slightly mishit. It squirmed under Murakami, but didn't have enough power to make it into the net. It was hacked away by a Fukuoka defender, and basically the referee blew up at that point. So, frustration for both Verde and Fukuoka. And indeed, I think for Kashiwa at Hitachi Dai, even though they had to come from behind against Sagan, the fact that they were unable to defeat a team who began the match day in the bottom six will have stung a bit. But these four clubs and these two games, Alan, anything you'd like to mention before we finish on and what you've seen from them so far?
I'm wondering if we're going to see even more from Avispa Fukuoka in the near future. I think they're a solid team, as we've seen now. But since Shahab Zaidi came in, he scored, 5 goals in 6 games or something like that. Mm. Excellent striker, a good finisher, not scared to shoot. He does also pass at certain times when you'd expect a striker to shoot, or certainly a greedy player to shoot. So he seems to know what he's doing. And Ryoga Sato returned to the team against his former team, Tokyo Verde, this time. He came on at the start of the second half, actually. And he's a player I like, so another forward. Sato is ready for them. And Nara came back, centre-back. He's been out a month. He's basically the team captain and the main centre-back. But even while he was away, they had Seiya Inoue, who was playing extremely well, and Tashiro Masaya, who used to play for Sagan Tosu, has actually been captaining the team at times. I've seen him with the armband on because they were missing Grolley and Mia as well. So, I mean, they've had a lot of injuries. And as far as I know right now, Mia might still be out. But I think most of their players are back and fit. And they have a few more attacking options. And I'm looking forward to seeing what the manager can do, because I think we can get a bit more out of them. I mean, if they lose 2-3 or they concede 3 goals, then suddenly he'll switch the keeper and half of the defence like he did last year. But at the moment, they're pretty solid and quite the same team, which is actually what happens at Reysol and Tosu, I think. I mean, literally both of those teams, I think at least 9, perhaps 10 of those players of both of those teams are the same every week these days. They both sort of settled the team nicely. Mm. Who are full of journeymen and no stars. So we won't expect too much from them, but as long as the manager can get them playing as a team and keep them off the bottom, they'll be happy. They kept Kawahara for, I was expecting him to go to a bigger club this season. And Park Il-gyu is still doing miracles at the back, but otherwise, you know, it'd be hard pushed the name of one of their players, really. But Kashiwa Reysol, they've I think the keeper and they have a player out at Sekine, the right back, is out at the under 23s. But Kawaguchi has been filling in for the last 3 games, but basically the back four and the goalkeeper have been the same all year, and they're doing solidly, nicely. And without Hosoya, who wasn't really, you know, running on all cylinders in the J1 anyway, they're sort of playing like with a false nine. They don't really have a centre forward. They push Koyamatsu up who's basically a winger, really, and Savio, who was a central midfielder, and they're both going up and rotating around. So they're playing, I would say, what's the word people say? They are more than the sum of their parts at the moment. They really have a star. I mean, Matias Savio gives everything and usually needs to come off by about 75 or 80 minutes because he really is. He's given everything and he's really tired. But they look a solid team. They don't really have that many players left in the squad to cover. Heaven forbid they had to bring Hugo Tatsuda on at centre-back, then they're in trouble. They have an extra centre-forward in Kosuke Kinoshita. But the fact that they don't play him shows that they want this centre forward. They're playing this sort of false nine thing, and Kinoshita comes on as a super sub. So I think and Verdi the same. I mean, apart from the fact that they had Taniguchi who got injured two games back, they've been almost the same team every week too. So these are four teams who they could do better, of course, but all four teams are quite solid and quite shall we say easy to predict in the lineup, and they don't really have any superstars playing for them. So these are four teams that in the end, sorry to say to all of them, but they're mid-table at best. But my hopes are for Avispa. I think that perhaps they can pull something out of the bag and improve, because they do have a great manager who can get the best out of players.
Yes, indeed. Very well said there, Alan. All right. So, that's all 10 games from J1 Match Day 10 rounded up then. And between now and our next episode, there will be two full rounds of top flight games played, as we're in, well, for some people, we're in the middle of the Golden Week period of holidays. Some very lucky people have a stretch of 10 days off in a row, but basically this coming Friday, May the 3rd, and then Monday, May the 6th, are both national holidays. So with that in mind, yes, there are, as I said, two full rounds of games slated for those two particular days. So what we've decided to do in the green room, listeners, is Alan's going to pick a game or two that he would recommend a neutral to watch on Friday, and then I'll do the same for Match Day 12 on Monday. So, Alan, what is Alan's pick of Friday? Alan's pick of Friday.
I'll be actually going to my pick on Friday. The game I'm going to watch and look very excited to watch it is the top team against the bottom team, Cerezo Osaka against Consadole Sapporo. I think it'll be great to see if Cerezo go all out in attack and try to rack up the goal difference and stay top of the league. And of course, they have Lucas Fernandez and Shunta Tanaka, who signed from Consadole during the break. So they have two former Consadole players who are quite key for them. And they are a team, again, I think probably the 11 will be very predictable, but certainly 10 of these players are just going to be playing automatically. And against Consadole, who, let's face it, they're not going to care. They're not going to be looking for a draw. They're going to be going all out. Sugeno, who was in goal, who was probably going to be to put out to pasture on the bench as Shuntakagi came in. But Shuntakagi got a knee injury and is basically out for the season. So Sugeno in goal and is showing all his experience from all his 20 years at the top, or well, at the middle, and he's great. So I think they're not going to be looking for a draw for sure, and I quite look forward to seeing what they put up. I'm looking forward to seeing and meeting Super Choc, and I think, and I probably said this last year or the year before, but I'll come back to it again. But their central midfield player, who's actually known to play up front and at centre back, as Consadole players do, Arano, I think is a very underrated or hardly mentioned player. He's the kind of guy that I think he would play in anybody's team anywhere. He's never going to be a star and he rarely score a goal, but he's everywhere. He's at the back, taking the ball off the keeper. He's up the front, crossing and pushing the defenders. So, I've recently become friends with him too, which is really nice. Daigo Nishi introduced us to name drop, sorry. But and Arano is a really nice guy and has invited me up to stay with him in Consadole. So it's been 22 years since I went to Sapporo to see England against Argentina in the World Cup.
Uh-huh.
Been there since. So I really want to go and see Consadole at home. and bother Arano. But it was great. So I'm looking forward to. And it's going to be very, shall we say, conflicted too, because I have a lot of players that I know personally now, and I feel that I would like to see them do well playing for Consadole, while I know a lot of the players at Cerezo, and they're the sort of local, the Kansai team that I would like to stay at the top. I like to see Cerezo, Vissel, Gamba, and even Kyoto Sanga would be nice up in the top half of the table. So it's going to be a conflicting, interesting game for me. So Cerezo and Consadole will not be a 0-0 draw, and I'd recommend it to anyone.
All right, that's a very good shout. And, yeah, as I segue on to Monday's games, you're definitely spoilt for choice in the Kansai region, Alan, as you have Kobe at home against Niigata, Gamba at home against Cerezo in the Osaka Derby. I'm pretty sure that's where you might be heading. And Kyoto at home against joint leaders Machida. But apart from that, yeah, I've got two games that I would recommend to a neutral. Of course, Machida, who I mentioned, traveled to Kyoto. They've garnered so much attention in the early going this season. One of the three promoted clubs flying high up at the sharp end of the table. Well, the other two promoted teams meet at Ajinomoto Stadium in one of the early games on Monday afternoon. Tokyo Verde host Iwata. So keep your eye on that one, listeners, if you're not tuning in to the Osaka Derby that kicks off at roughly the same time. But the second game I can recommend is the late evening game at 5 o'clock at Saitama Stadium. Urawa Reds host Yokohama F. Marinos. And that is always a highly charged occasion. So it should be a terrific one. Reds coming off that victory against Nagoya, and F. Marinos, well, their players, I'm sure, still cock a hoop after making it through to the ACL final. But yes, coming off the draw in Osaka against Cerezo. So, I think you're spoiled for choice across both days, both match days that are upcoming, listeners. So wherever you are around the world, we hope you're able to catch a J-League game or two. And that's just about it for this episode, Alan. But before we let you go and before we wrap things up, the last time you're on, you were mentioning that there was a new issue of J Soccer magazine in the works. So I imagine, as we're recording weeks later, that we must be getting closer to the eventual release date. So what can you tell us about the progress of the new issue, and when it will be out on the streets?
I've decided on the final 40 pages. I was going for 48 or 36 or I've basically finished. I mean, I'm very happy to say that I have two pages left that I need to complete. And then, of course, I have to proofread it about 100 times to make sure that there's no errors whatsoever. But I finished it, and it's great. I love it. I'm so excited, because it's been, I think it's a year and a half since the last magazine due to things. There's a Vissel Kobe 2023 champions get themselves about 8 pages and some story and lots of really good pictures from Lionel Piguet. And I've got a page 3 boy, as I mentioned before, the J Talk podcast page 3 boy, but we've still got his shirt on. Since we've spoken, Makoto Hasebe has announced his retirement, so I've just done a little story on him and a picture or two. What I found was, as I mentioned before, is very popular every year. The J-League shirts are huge around the world. They may be expensive, although at the current rate of exchange, it's getting a lot cheaper. Mm. But J-League shirts take up about probably about 12 pages of the magazine, because people just love the J-League shirts. If it's not J-League shirts, then it's the groundhoppers, people who want to know all about the ground. So in this particular one, we've gone for the shirts, but maybe the grounds get a look next time. Thanks to Lionel Piguet's connections in Switzerland, Servette have been very nice to talk to us. It actually started with talking to Servette's manager, Rene Wehler, who used to be at Kashima Antlers.
Right.
But obviously, Takuma Nishimura has moved there from Yokohama F. Marinos. So he was kind enough to come on with us for about 2 hours in our living room by phone and talk to us about anything. His English isn't bad at all. We did most of it in Japanese, but it was funny because he sort of drifted off into English now and again, especially when he didn't want, for example, no comment or I cannot say, you know, questions that he couldn't answer. So that was good. That was nice. And I managed to, I mentioned him just about a few minutes ago, Superchuk Sarachat of Consadole Sapporo, a little article on him. The final two pages, I've decided, it's not done yet, but I've decided to look at Justin Hubner of Cerezo Osaka, who just signed on loan from Wolverhampton Wanderers in the Premier League. He's an Indonesian national team, and he's playing in the under 23 semi-final tonight, or this week as we record. So he's obviously not playing for Cerezo this week, so I'm not going to get an interview out of that, sadly. But I think Justin Hubner, and being an Indonesian, it'd be interesting to see if I can get some of the Indonesian boys interested in the magazine as well as the J League itself. We've seen what, in fact, Justin Hubner has 1 million followers on Instagram. So, you know, for a young man who we've never heard of until he turned up at Cerezo Osaka a few weeks ago, the guy's got 1 million followers on. So maybe I should put him on the cover.
Yeah.
But it's really quite an interesting story, which I'm yet to write out completely. But the fact, I mean, last weekend or two games back now, I think he played for Cerezo Osaka and then got on a plane and 18 hours later was coming on as a sub for Indonesia in the under 23s. So I look forward to getting to know him personally in the next couple of weeks when he returns. And I'm wondering if he's going to stay in Japan and make a name for himself. But he's the final two pages if all goes to plan. So the magazine will, my plan was to send it to the printers this week, but it is Golden Week, as we've mentioned. So next week, I hope to send the magazine out to the printers, and maybe a couple of weeks later, I'll be bombarding everyone with, please buy a magazine from me on various social media networks. So thank you for the opportunity to mention it. And anyone out there, please do get in touch if you like a magazine. J Soccer Magazine on Twitter, or X as it's now called, or alan@jsoccer.com by email, or I'm sure you can find me. If you're listening to this, then your interest in Japanese football is enough that I'm sure you can find my name out there somewhere. Thank you very much.
Yeah, brilliant stuff, Alan. Really looking forward to, page three aside, looking forward to seeing what's in the rest of the magazine. But, thanks for the opportunity to feature myself and the podcast. That is very much appreciated. And as I say, looking forward to, what's in store for the new issue. It, as you say, it has been a while, but, I'm sure a lot of loyal fans of Japanese football will be, champing at the bit as well to get their hands on a copy, either physical or digital. But we'll leave it there, Alan. Very much appreciate you filling the breach in Johnny's absence tonight. It was great to get your thoughts on this round of games and the season to this point. And we look forward to catching up with you again soon as the season progresses, and good luck on getting the magazine all tied up.
Thank you, and apologies to Johnny for not being as literate and well-spoken as he is, and apologies to the listeners for spouting on about the game I love too much, perhaps. The pleasure, of course, was all yours.
It always is, mate. We very much appreciate it. So we'll leave it there. That's it for this episode of the J-Talk podcast. I'd like to thank Alan again for filling in for Johnny this week. Thanks to Stuart for his thoughts on F. Marinos. And thanks to our patrons for their ongoing support on Patreon. Thanks to you listeners as well for listening wherever you are. We'll be back a day later than usual next week, recording our next episode on Tuesday night for a Wednesday release. And we'll round up what's happened in Golden Week in match days 11 and 12. We'll speak to you then. Bye for now.
The J Talk Podcast. Yes, 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 yes.